Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now our guest is Stephen Mosier. He's an American social scientist, a pro-life activist. He's also an author, and his latest book is called Bully of Asia. We'll find out about that in just a moment. He founded an organization called Population Research Institute, and the website for that is pop.org, P-O-P.org. Stephen, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Well, it's good to be here, Jerry.
All right. I wanted to ask you this. Who is the bully of Asia?
Well, the bully of Asia is the same country that has always been the bully of Asia. From its very beginning, 2,000 years ago, China has been a country that has expanded by military conquest, by civilizational advance, by cultural imperialism over much of East Asia. And it's only a matter of sheer luck that Vietnam, countries like Vietnam and Korea, are still independent nations today, because for centuries they were occupied by China, and I think China would like to reoccupy them today. So China, you know, is the bully of Asia, and we see that very clearly these days in its effort to remold, reshape the world order around itself. It doesn't like the U.S.-dominated world order that's been in place since World War II, and it would like to create a new Chinese-centered, Sino-centric world order where Beijing would be, in effect, the capital of the world, and industry would be located in China, and the rest of the world would be a source of raw materials for the Chinese industrial machine and of course, a market for Chinese consumer products. That's the world that China is trying to put in place now.
And where does North Korea fit in that, in terms of Kim Jong-un and the recent developments with President Trump at least meeting with him to possibly discuss, you know, denuclearization of North Korea?
Well, I think that President Trump has taken a bold initiative. He brought about this in very cleverly. You know, I used to write speeches for President Ronald Reagan after he left office, and
oh, wow.
We called President Reagan the great communicator. But Trump, in his own way, is a great communicator as well as being the great disruptor. Because, first of all, he communicated loudly and clearly to Kim Jong-un, Little Rocket Man, in ways that no one else had ever communicated, the idea that the United States was not going to tolerate its nuclear weapons, its nuclear arsenal. You know, the statements like my nuclear button is bigger than your nuclear button, and we will visit fire and fury on North Korea if North Korea attacks us. You know, the diplomats, the guys in the pinstripe suits, were a little upset at that wording, but it got Kim Jong-un's attention. Importantly, it got him to come to the table at the Singapore summit. The other thing Trump did, of course, was he put North Korea in a box economically. He got the United Nations, that is to say, all the countries of the world, to go along with sanctions on North Korea, including China, which wasn't easy because 90% of North Korea's trade is with China. And then finally, he got Kim Jong-un alone in the room and said, look, young man, you can go one of two ways. You can go down the path of continued nuclearization and remain poor and backward, or you can give up your nukes and missiles and come into the modern world. And I think that message got through to Kim Jong-un. I think we have a long way to go, But look, Kim Jong-un has just announced that all political prisoners are going to be given amnesty North Korea on the 70th anniversary of the founding of North Korea. Now, there are an awful lot of political prisoners in North Korea, Jerry. I mean, 15% of the population is in labor camps. They're not all political prisoners. But even if he releases, you know, tens of thousands of people, that will be the first time we've seen even a little ray of light when it comes to human rights in North Korea for a long, long time. So I don't think that would have happened without President Trump, quite frankly.
Yeah, that's very interesting. By the way, just as a quick point, sometimes when talking with people about the problem of the persecution of Christians internationally, when asking the question, you know, who is the worst of the persecutors, and the answer almost always is North Korea. But explain to me North Korea's relationship to China.
Well, North Korea is a tributary state of China. It's a vassal state of China. North Korea wouldn't exist if it weren't for China's intervention in the Korean War, everyone will recall. And it wouldn't really be able to survive today without aid and trade from Big Brother China. They have similar political systems. Obviously, they're one-party dictatorships. They have similar leaders in Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping. All power resides in their hands. And China, of course, has been the country that has been a spoiler in past efforts by the United States to negotiate a peace treaty on the Korean Peninsula and end that long-running war, the longest-running war in the world, I think. A spoiler in this sense, China really doesn't want to solve the Korean War problem because it doesn't want Korean reunification. Korean reunification, the North and the South coming together, the Democratic South joining together with the autocratic North, might create a free market democracy on China's very border. It might bring American troops right up to the border with China, the Yellow River, and that's the last thing China wants. So China has, every time we've tried under Clinton, under Bush one, under Obama, to try to solve the North Korean problem, China has along with Russia, has really sat at the table and blocked any progress. Well, now we've put tremendous pressure on China in trade terms, right? We've asked them to rectify the trade imbalance. We've said you've got to stop your cyber attacks on the United States, your reckless expansion in the South China Sea. So I think China, for the first time, is beginning to play ball where North Korea is concerned. They need to be watched. They tend to cheat. Actually, they cheat a lot. But they persecute their Christians in China, too, and that's a topic for another day, but there's a lot of increasing persecution of the home church movement, the Catholic churches, in fact, all religions in China today.
When you said the longest running war, you're talking about Korea? In which case you go...
Yeah, the Korean War.
Yeah, because the only reason I mentioned that is then obviously the 100-year war would be longer, but maybe that wasn't the same thing. But what are your comments on this?
Well, that's been a few centuries since 100 Years' War, in Europe, of course, which tore Europe apart and led to the Treaty of Westphalia, where we decided, in Europe at least, that all nations would have a seat at the table and be able to negotiate treaties and abide by them. What we have on the Korean Peninsula is a war that has been going on since 1950. I mean, there has been only an armistice, a temporary, period of peace, that from 1953 on, we've never signed a peace treaty. Mm. And so you could say that war has been going on for 68 years. Let's call it the longest running war of the
of
the last 200 years, say.
All right. As long as I've been alive, then, Korea has been kind of at war. I didn't realize that. Okay. That's an interesting thought. All right. China, let me ask you this. This is a kind of a strange thing, but there was a story about 5 years ago where it said that some elite thinkers and within the government of China were saying, you know, what was it that really made the West what it was, and in particular the United States, in terms of the prosperity, the political freedom, all the different things that caused it to become this major superpower in history? And they said when you isolated it down, the Christianity factor was absolutely key. But I never heard anything further from that study, but I thought this is an interesting thing. If some some Chinese intellectuals are beginning to recognize this kind of thing, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's true. First of all, I think that the fact that we get the rule of law from that goes all the way back to ancient Israel, where the judges had such a prominent place and the law played such a big role in the life of the Jewish people. And of course we get the rule of law from Rome, we get democracy from Athens, but it was Christianity that really told the emperors in the West, you're in charge of the world, the material world, the secular world we call it, but the sacred world is something else, and that you're not to run a religion. The people are to have a personal relationship with Christ and with God. And that division of power, right, between the secular and the sacred, created a space in which people were free to do any number of things. They were free to form families and have children. They were free to start businesses. They were free to operate outside the rule of an oppressive government. That has never, that kind of freedom has never been found in China. Over 2,000 years ago in China, you had exactly the opposite. In China, you had a form of government that's very close to what we call today bureaucratic totalitarianism. You had the emperor who had all power in his hands. You had a secret police in the military. You had political commissars everywhere. You had government control of the economy, important sectors of the economy, including land, production of iron, salt, and other things. You had song and dance troops going around the country singing propaganda odes to the emperor, praising him. So in China, you had everything we associate with modern Marxist-Leninism, which we thought was an invention of Karl Marx and Vladimir Lenin, was invented by China over 2,000 years ago. Mm. And that's the form of government they still have today. And so they've gone in the other direction. So I do think that the fact that of the lack of freedom in China, the lack of freedom of conscience, the lack of freedom of religion, or freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of assembly, freedom to form labor unions, for example, all of that lack of freedom will severely handicap China in the future and is probably the biggest hurdle to development. Will they allow those freedoms? No, not under the current system of government.
Are there some, though, within the Chinese authorities that recognize these things, or they're just basically dissidents?
Well, you've got two countervailing trends going on here. You've got Christianity spreading very rapidly in China, with I think well over 100 million Christians now, some of whom aren't very well formed in matters of faith, but nonetheless call themselves Christians and deserve to be recognized as such. And then you've got Xi Jinping, who is the new Mao Zedong, who is the new Chairman Mao, who is launching a kind of new high-tech cultural revolution, seeking to control not just what people read in the official newspaper and hear on the radio and TV, but also what they think. You know, there is a high-tech dictatorship in China today which monitors everything that you post on the Internet, everything you buy, everywhere you go is all sent to the government, and the government agency will give you a social credit score, and we really should call it a political credit score. And if you go to good places and if you say nice things about the Emperor Xi Jinping, the new president for life, your political credit score goes up. And if you associate with people who are critical of the regime, or if you go places for meetings of the underground church, for example, your political credit score will go down. And you know what? If it gets low enough, even if you haven't committed a crime, they will arrest you and send you to re-education camps because they think even though you haven't committed a crime, you're likely to in the near future because your thoughts are so impure. And so we have thought re-education coming back to China. So, China's moving in many ways in the wrong direction, away from freedom towards increasing tyranny.
That's incredible. Big Brother is watching then. Now, let me ask you this. Around 1980 or thereabouts, they did allow, late 70s, they did allow some form of small free enterprise. We have about a minute left, and that did help to change their economy. In other words, it wasn't just pure 100% communism. Where does that factor in?
Well, I was in China. I was the first American social scientist allowed into China back in 1979. Teaching at Stanford University. And I still was there when the commune system ended. The Chinese people had been starving under the commune system. The land was given back to them. Food production went up. They were able to start small businesses.
Yeah.
But now things are moving in the other direction with the government controlling industry increasingly and demanding seats on the boards of directors of even privately owned companies. So we're seeing increased control across the economy.
Okay, well, we're basically out of time. Let me go ahead and give the name of your book again. It's Bully of Asia. The author is Stephen Mosher. Mosher is spelled Mosher. His website, including information on the book, is pop, as in population, pop, POP.org. Thank you so much, Mr. Mosher. Good to talk with you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye now.